It has been said by many that we need the Bible in one hand and the newspaper in the other. We must not allow a divorce between our private spirituality and the events and circumstances and politics that are going on all around us. We must no longer withdraw from society into pietistic solitude. And we have to help, therefore, to help one another process change and to think biblically about what is going on in these days. The Bible, I believe, is God's key to unlock history. It explains the past, it changes the present, and it prepares us for the future. It explains the past, it changes the present, and it prepares us for the future. The first page here of the handout I have called Trends and Challenges. I do distinguish between those two words. A trend is something that I suggest we analyze. A challenge is something that we confront. There are any manner of trends out there. You've only just got to read a couple of columns of newsprint, a couple of columns of Gallup poll, a couple of reports on the Democratic Convention this week to figure out a list of 50 trends. Which trends has our calling on them, our mark as individuals, as navigators, to confront? A trend, if you like, is a cold and a factual thing, but a challenge is a strenuous and a living thing. And when we discern a trend, it will become a challenge that we accept when it's seen through the eyes of Jesus Christ. That's the point of transition from trend to challenge. The Jesus Christ whose stomach churned when he looked out among the people and he saw that they were harassed and helpless. At that point, some sociological data became a challenge and it gripped him emotionally. Arnold Toynbee, probably the greatest historian of this century, spent much of his life reflecting on entire civilizations in terms of challenge and response. Challenge and response. That was the whole basis of his analytical approach. And our question is, how do we respond? How do we select and respond the challenges that God has put before us in his world today? Some people are saying that we have reached the end of history. These are not eschatological statements. These are statements based upon the ending of the Cold War. The most provocative historical essay, I believe, published in America at the end of the last decade, was written by a State Department analyst by the name of Francis Fukuyama. He wrote an essay called The End of History. And in it, he argued, this is most curious, he argued that we are reaching a universal state where contradictions have been resolved, where needs have been satisfied, where there's no more need for generals and for statesmen. Fukuyama's actual words in this article, he said, "It matters very little what strange thoughts occur to people in Albania or Burkina Faso. Clearly, the vast bulk of the Third World remains mired in history. But international life, for the most of us who have reached the end of history, will be more preoccupied with economics than with politics or strategy. The end of history is a very sad time," he said. "There will be neither art nor philosophy, just the perpetual caretaking of the museum of human history, the prospect of centuries of boredom." A highly respected analyst in the U.S. State Department, writing 2.5 years ago, the month after he wrote Tiananmen Square. 3 months later, September, the beginning of the end of apartheid. I had the privilege of being in Cape Town when Desmond Tutu was given permission for the first time to march. That was the beginning. Then the falling of the dominoes in Eastern Europe. Then the collapse of the Soviet Union. My point is that we have been through a surfeit of history. History has become so constant that we can hardly digest it. Now, where did Fukuyama go wrong? What happened? I believe that this is a very, very intelligent man. In fact, he's now working for the Rand Corporation. He's just published a large book. 1,000 people came out to listen to him in London recently. He is definitely a grade A guru. We have to respect his intellectual capability. But He is a child of the Enlightenment, a tidy, intelligent child of the Enlightenment. He does not understand the primal human forces that run from Genesis to Revelation. In his categorization of human life, he does not have boxes for oppression, race, greed, religion, sin. He doesn't think in these ways. He's economic man. So, history has become very tidy. The Americans won, the Russians lost. Life should be rather boring. The Iraqi invasion was not a boring event. But notice that it was not an East-West event. It is true that the Cold War has ended and those concrete polarizations between the evil empire and the good guys have collapsed. But this is going to produce in this decade not blandness and boredom, but an astonishing turbulence and an astonishing uncertainty. We need to have eyes to see and to respond to the challenge. And by the way, let me just add one other thing here. Perspective is vitally important. Let me show you a couple of slides which have really helped me to understand differences in perspectives. These two slides are in an atlas of geopolitics published by some Frenchmen. This slide shows the situation, in fact they both do, at the end of the Second World War. The Cold War is beginning. This slide, which is not distorted, shows, I think, how we in the West felt about the great Russian bear. Notice it. It is looming right over us. It is about to trample us, right? Do you see how terrible the Red Menace is? It already appears to have obliterated and conquered half the known world. No wonder we were scared. It is devouring us. In Greece, in Malaysia, in the Philippines, in Berlin, in Indonesia, in communist insurrections, in Tibet, all over the world at that time, the Russians and the Chinese were fomenting trouble. And we were facing the very genuine prospect of communism moving down even further. We felt threatened. The bear was leaning on us. How did the Russians feel at this time? Different perspective. Here is a photograph of the world, a map of the world. It is not distorted. It is merely a projection looking from the North Pole downwards. Now, I want you to see here that the peace-loving Soviets, here they are totally surrounded by the Western barbarians. We have the Second Fleet in the Atlantic. We have the Seventh Fleet waiting off China to pounce. We have the Sixth Fleet down here. We have another fleet up here. All around, they are encircled. They have no warm water ports. In the Mediterranean, for example. Mediterranean, there. The U.S. Sixth Fleet. Everywhere they turn, they are encircled by a hostile ring of capitalists. Perspective is everything. Do you see that? Remarkable pair of charts. No distortion. No wonder they were scared. And no wonder we were scared, because we used the other chart. We should have switched charts. Okay. Now, unpredictability. There are only three aspects of our future which we can agree are highly likely. It will be faster, it will be more complex, and it will be more interdependent. The rest is intelligent guessing. There is very little stability left. I read two or three short articles on science each week because my background is philosophy and I want to try and have a little bit of an entree into these realms which are not my realms. I mean, reading these articles over the last 5 to 10 years, those of you who are mathematicians will understand this much better than I do, I have noticed that there are three new branches of mathematics that are often written about, even for laymen like me. They are called chaos theory, catastrophe theory, and crisis theory. And I'm serious. These are three new branches of mathematics which did not exist 15 years ago. Chaos, catastrophe, and crisis. This says something about the human condition at this time. This says something about turbulence. This says something in opposition to Fukuyama. Life is not about to be boring. Much humility is needed at this point. Ecclesiastes, chapter 7, verses 13 and 14. Ecclesiastes 7, 13 and 14 just about sums it up. It's a good verse to read and then sit down. But I'll go on a little longer. Consider what God has done. Who can straighten what he has made crooked? When times are good, be happy. When times are bad, consider. God has made the one as well as the other. Therefore, a man cannot discover anything about his future. Well, it's not quite as bad as that, but it is not easy. But the thing that we need to take hold of as believers is that these times, because of all that I'm describing here, they provide what President Havel of Czechoslovakia called an opening for the transcendental. I talked a little bit about this yesterday when I was talking about tribalism. These times provide an opening for the transcendental. There are enough problems out there that the average person is seeking solutions that go beyond his normal vocabulary. We can lift up Jesus Christ, and we can have the privilege of meeting many, many insecurities and needs. On the handout here, there are seven general trends and challenges. I'll make just one comment about each, just one. People power. You know where I got that phrase? Charisma Kino. You remember that? It hasn't gone too well in the Philippines. And I originated this as a trend that I was observing 2 years ago. And I almost deleted it last week. And then the lights came on again. And I thought, no, I mustn't delete it. What is the latest example of people power? Ross Perot. Huh? Yes. Okay. Ross Perot has just emerged out of nowhere. He is a classic example of a person sustained by the yearnings of people who have little faith in the current system, little faith in the current leaders. And in these postmodern days, we are going to see more Ross Perots. He is of the same lineage as Lech Walesa 10 years ago, who came out of nowhere, an electrician and a unionist. Desmond Tutu, Vaclav Havel, the Romanian pastor who precipitated the Romanian Revolution and overthrew Ceausescu, Boris Yeltsin, came out of nowhere, stood on a tank at the time of the coup, captivated people's hearts. The lawyers in Nairobi at the moment who stand against the government, anonymous heroes, autonomous heroes, people who come out of nowhere. There will be many of these, because this is the sort of world in which we are, and we need to be alert to them. These are people who choose the moment, choose the kairos. Tribalism. Talked about that yesterday. You understand where I'm coming from? It is serious. I want you to know it's serious, and it's serious in the West. 15% of the vote in the municipal elections recently in France went to Monsieur Le Pen's party. Monsieur Le Pen is on record several times as saying, quote, the Nazi gas chambers were only a small detail in World War II, unquote. Serious. It's not just something that goes on among tribes in Africa. On a more humorous note, there was a survey done in my country, Scotland, a short while ago, and the survey said that 4 out of 5 Scotsmen would like to be independent of England, to be separate from England. And I consulted my country leader, whom I'm responsible to over there, James Broad, and he said, oh yes, and 4 out of 5 Englishmen would like to get rid of Scotland. So we have tribalism that's serious and tribalism which is a little bit more frivolous. A current example of tribalism in America is the politically correct movement. An insidious movement, an anti-gospel movement, a people-separating movement, a vulgar movement. We have to work against things like this. And we have to love our brothers and sisters because part of the reason that movements like the politically correct movement emerge is that we dominant Anglos have not treated other people well, and therefore they're coming back at us. It's called the politically correct movement. You often see it on university campuses in America. You have to be very careful the words you use to describe things. You have to be careful that any minority is given ample space to do almost anything, and the majority is kept in check. Some of the others here could give you some illustrations of that movement. Some of those are in there, exactly. Multipolarity, I think I talked about this yesterday, is pretty clear from the sub-points here. When the superpowers decline, Fukuyama didn't see out bubbles sin, lust, greed, and oppression. George Bush talks about a new international order. I see more of the progressive breakdown of international order if we look several years ahead. What's happening now is that small conflicts are taking place, started by people who have very large weapons, much more serious than in the Cold War, fewer controls. I look at the Houston summit that was held in 2 years ago of the G7 group, and I analyzed what was going on at that summit. When it came to lending to the USSR, the Germans made the running and the rest didn't agree. When it came to lending to China, the Japanese made the running and the rest didn't agree. When it came to ending agricultural subsidies, the USA made the running and the others didn't agree. Chaos. The latest G7 summit in Munich last month, nobody led. It's a serious situation. We're entering an era of interconnection, multiple impacts, and who your allies are depend on the topic. I could illustrate this if I took 5 minutes through the Uruguay round of trade. You know, where basically the Americans are beating up on the Europeans, the South is beating up on the North, Australia is beating up on Canada. The whole thing is the breakdown of the traditional alliances. Okay, demographics. We know the statistics about the large cities of the world. We know that the world is urbanizing. One poignant thing that comes through to me, and as I think about this, is that in Mexico City, there are 10 million kids. That says more to me than how many million people there are. There are 10 million children, most of them needy. 45% of all Africans are under 15 years old. 40,000 children a day die from malnutrition and starvation, according to the United Nations. 40,000 a day, day after day, this week, children die of starvation. Economic stress. There's a tremendous misallocation of resources in the world today. There's probably enough to go around, as you know, but human sin is distorting the patterns of distribution. In 1989, the richest 20% of human beings held 84% of the world's wealth, and the poorest 20% of human beings held 1% of the world's wealth. And it's getting wider, the gap. Things are going on in the world which you and I are not aware of. Two brief examples, slavery and piracy. I belong to the Anti-Slavery Society. It's based in London. There are 200 million slaves in the world today. These are bond slaves, indentured in Mauritania, in southern Sudan, people who cannot escape from the wage bondage in which they are. This is a United Nations figure. This is not some pressure group trying to stir up and raise money. This is a United Nations figure, 200 million slaves. There was a meeting on it in New York a few weeks ago. Piracy. Do pirates still exist? One would have thought not. There were 61 reported cases of piracy in the Malacca Straits off Singapore in the first 6 months of last year. These are very genuine pirates. They climb up the sides of ships. They have revolvers stuck in their waistband. They steal things. They rape people. They go down the ropes again in the night and they disappear. They are pirates. we have a lot of things that are the effect of economic stress. I'm most concerned about Africa. Africa used to be marginalized. I'll say that again. Africa used to be exploited. I talked about the British and the others running a railroad down to get the stuff out, get the people out. It used to be exploited. Now it's just marginalized. Because what you might call the doctors of development, all the bright people from the World Bank and everyone else, where are they? Eastern Europe and Russia. They've left Africa. Africa is becoming marginalized, and it's sinking economically. And then there's the issue of the environment that goes alongside this and makes economic stress even more complicated. Spreading technology. All I want to do here is just take a shot at some very respectable people, such as Nesbitt. I do not find much evidence for the fact that the world is becoming more globalized. I find instead things like tribalism. I think there is an elite that drinks Coca-Cola, that travels on planes, that speaks English, that keeps connecting more and more and is becoming more and more American. But the vast mass of humanity are not getting globalized. I see the reverse trend. Religious ferment. The church is changing. Let me just take the example of the Archbishop of Canterbury. We have a new one, us Anglicans. His name is George Carey. He is evangelical. He is green. He is for the ordination of women. He is sensitive to social justice. He is charismatic. He has lots of dialogue with Roman Catholics. He has a doctorate in early church history. And he loves grassroots evangelism. This is somewhat of a Renaissance man. The old categories are breaking down. Religious ferment. You cannot categorize a man like that and say he's on our side. He'd be okay with the navigators, or he wouldn't be okay with the navigators. We're losing our categories. Islam. 40 countries already have an Islamic majority. Last year, according to the best estimates, the number of Muslims passed 1,000 million. 1,000 million people who claim to be Muslims. Islam feeds on poverty, it feeds on social injustice. It has an enormously high birth rate. In the Yemen, the average woman, not the fertile woman, but the average woman has 8 babies. Islam. Falling death rate, high birth rate, population growing around the world at 3% per year. Growing hopelessness in North Africa is leading to very strong Islamic movements. And they mean business. They're more organized than we are. For example, in East Africa, there is a documented plan, which I have seen, that they want to place one mosque every 10 kilometers along all the main roads of East Africa. East Africa is a challenge to them. It's a very Christian area in terms of its heritage. One mosque every 10 kilometers. Very clear planning. Pluralism, I talk about here, right at the bottom of the page. This is the cocktail era. Shake up your religions, add a dash of this, add a dash of that, and it should taste good. We have to stand against the cocktail era in religion. We have to stand against syncretism, the shake and serve mentality. I used to think that this country was secularized. I used to think that my country was secularized. I see that that was just a symptom. It's not, it's pagan. Modernity is the key. Modernity produces secularism. But after a time, people become tired of the emptiness and blandness of secularism, and they return to their religion. The Druids in Britain are growing by leaps and bounds. They go worship at Stonehenge. The New Age people here. There is what somebody has called the revenge of the sacred. The sacred is coming back to brush away the secularized. And this is happening in our country, and the West is sick. My daughter Allison spent a few months in France last year with the navigators. She watched television. She saw a children's television cartoon for kids. The theme was animal sacrifice. What fun, what fascination, how good for kids. And then I open a book on France and I read that it is, quote, 97% evangelized, 82% Christian. Rubbish. I doubt that the West can ever be converted unless we get our minds screwed back into the ways in which God wants us to think. I'm going to stop. I've told you the bad news. I haven't told you the good news. Maybe we'll have some good news tomorrow and we'll talk about how we're responding, what some of these needs are. But I really feel the need, because I spoke for approximately an hour yesterday, to not keep on sharing my ignorance with you, but just do a little listening here, do a little interacting, and stop. Yes?
How much of the slavery do you see in the U.S.? What percentage of this 200 million do you perceive to be in the U.S.? And are you saying that this is primarily a wage bondage? Is that what higher do you think?
I don't think there's much that is classified by the United Nations as slavery in the Americas.
Donald, can you repeat the question?
Yes. The question is, how much slavery is there in the USA? My response is, of the 200 million that I've seen statistics on, it is primarily concentrated in the resistant belt that runs across North Africa and through the Middle East. These would be Filipina women working in Kuwait before the war. These would be desert people working in Libya, people who are pulled out of their natural environment and forced hundreds of miles away from where they are to be indentured, and their documents are taken away. Now, in the Caribbean, I think there is some evidence for something approaching that in some of the fruit plantations and so on. But some of you know much more about the Caribbean than I do. Yes? That's a great question. Where do I see AIDS fitting into the challenge? All I would say is that it is yet another indication of the godlessness of these days. I don't know if Jerry White used this cartoon last night. He was using it with me. Did he use the cartoon which is of a picture, I think, of a schoolmaster and says, we don't mind condoms, but no Bibles, please. Did he show you that cartoon? Okay, well, that's not a funny cartoon. That is a deeply true and sad cartoon for this country. Condoms are great, but don't you ever put the scriptures in our school system. So AIDS, you know, I don't have a conspiracy theory about it. I just feel it's part of the tragedy. Yes? I'd like to touch on that a little bit, if I may, tomorrow when I come to the page which is Navigator Responses and Needs. But I'd like to warn you that I don't have a remit to speak much about the USA. You would need to turn to Terry and his team. They've done a tremendous amount of analytical work, and I think a lot of you have seen it. And so I would get drawn beyond my purpose. Yes?
Do you know what we're learning? This relates to the U.S., but really overseas. Bob Pagano and his project of ministering in some of the U.S. cities in order to go to Muslim countries.
What are we learning from Bob Pagano and the project of working with Arabs in U.S. cities in order to go to Muslim cities? I think it's early in the day, but I think it has a great deal of potential. Because, as you know, people do not respect boundaries any longer. There are more people in Detroit from Ur of the Chaldees, which is where Abraham came from, than there are in Iraq, which is where Ur of the Chaldees is. I'm not sure if Ur is still a city. But seriously, the opportunity to reach people outside their own culture is becoming more and more strategic. This is why the Navigators have, I think, around 50 staff couples working among international students. At first glance, I look at that and I say, that's weird, because there are only 500,000 international students in America. So why do we have 50 staff couples working with them? That's the most intensive coverage that we've ever done anywhere in the world. Then I stand back and I think about it and I see the strategic nature of these people. I listen to Jim White talking about the caliber of the Chinese people he's working with in Oklahoma and their future on the mainland. And Vedano is doing the same. He's set up in Las Cruces, in Detroit, in Texas, and in a couple of other places, little laboratories of Arabs and others who are preparing for the long haul in the U.S., in the Arab world. So I think that's a very important thing. We need to nurture it and need to pray for it. Yeah.
Just have a question about
age.
In terms of, I mean, I don't suppose we've talked about the role, because here in the United States, that's going to greatly affect our ministry, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But when you talk about Africa, it's, I mean, we're talking totally different process. Mm-hmm. What's your evaluation? What's going to affect the
ministry? How age is going to affect the USA? Again, I think I'd like to defer to American navigators to speak to that. Who would like to speak to that? Who has thought about that? Bob Lovon. Come on, Bob. What's it like to get old? You're right. Oh. Well, no one seems willing to throw much light. The question seriously is, what is the impact of the changing pattern of ages in the USA? By which I assume we mean the baby boom generation, the enormous quantity of people who are now retired, and the cycles that we're going through in our age composition in the USA. How is that changing us? How is that affecting us? Yes. Okay. First of all, Bud, I'm sorry we didn't get anywhere on age. You know, I don't want to waste your time by saying things that I only half understand. So you must turn to other people fluent in this culture. The second question here had to do with what can we present to church boards, or how can we help churches get more on board in the area of missions? Well, first of all, I think we're aware, you're aware of ACMC and of their work in working with church mission agencies, with church mission boards. A very good organization, very solid, and have done a lot of good. Secondly, I think the navigators have not done very well in preparing material for us to take to our churches that makes sense. We sort of rely on missionaries coming back and talking to the mission committee, but we have not been able to equip ourselves who live here to do this very well. In my opinion, it's not that complicated. And I think Ray Ho and his team are aware of the need. Paul Hensley, in particular, is working in this area. He's responsible for communicating missions within the USA. He's down in the US building, was our leader in Malaysia. And I think I'll just say that your best bet is to get in touch with Paul Hensley. We need to do more than we're doing. We need to be more proactive, and we need to uphold our vision and our calling and explain, as I stressed yesterday, why American missionaries are still necessary, because the word is out that they're not. And the word is also out that unless you're going off to some totally unreached tribe, you're probably wasting money. Both of these are wrong. And any time you would like some help from me in trying to establish their wrongness, just give me a call. Yeah.
You made the comment now that Islam was trying to impoverish
why is it that thrives in that particular environment?
Islam. The question is, why does Islam feed on poverty? I'm not an expert on Islam, but it is a religion which appeals to the underdog. It appeals to the underdog because it speaks to ordinary people and it offers them a direct connection with God that bypasses hierarchy, bypasses their unjust rulers, and tells them that if you do five very simple things, which anybody can do, however poor he is, namely pray five times a day, etc., etc., you can get yourself on an equal footing with other people as regards God. So it's a religion which in its simplicity appeals. Secondly, I think it's a religion which through the tithe or zakat has always reached out to poor people, has always taken care of its own. One of the reasons why the Muslim Brotherhood is so successful in Egypt is they come into the small villages of Upper Egypt and they fix things. They do the sort of thing that D.L. Moody did, but which the Great Reversal has told us evangelicals not to do, because our gospel is word, not deed, right? Wrong. But they missed that. They didn't get on board in that liberalism, modernism thing in the 1920s. It wasn't in their part of the world at all. And so they are still sorting out villages and making sure they get sanitation and making sure that people can read and write. And thirdly, they are really messianic. They are out to conquer the world with their God and their religion. And sometimes I wish we had half the energy. So there are others here. You want to say anything on Islam?
They're very sensitive. If you go for poor people, they're poor people. They're very sensitive about that. Because their intent is in that direction.
Yep. Right. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I have a question now. New Asian movement, how about in this country, spread out how's influential right now?
The New Age movement, how influential is it in the USA? Well. You're pushing me back against the wall and trying to make me talk about the USA. Who lives in California here? Okay, there's our panel on the New Age movement. But seriously, I think that it has peaked from what I read. I try and read a lot of material on these things. I think that it's going to be replaced, however, by the wrapping will change, the content will continue. And the content basically is we have a hole in our hearts that needs to be filled with something spiritual. Christianity doesn't do it very well in many cases, and when that happens, we just reach out for anything that will give us that sense of being meaningful. What we have to do is to offer the two things which are unique to Jesus Christ. Jesus offers us identity and dignity. And the more we get into situations where there is a cocktail of religions, I think the more we need to address the question of who am I, my identity, and what am I worth, my dignity. People who are getting into the New Age movement have very little sense of worth, and so they look for something to give them worth, and so forth. That's a very imperfect answer, but again, not my main topic. I'm going to stop now because I did promise the leadership committee here 10 minutes for announcements.